Who's in, who's out, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Parts of Trump's travel ban go into effect, and immigration lawyers expect new legal battles.
The person who's coming as a fiancé, to even qualify for that visa, you have to have already been in a relationship and be planning on getting married. If that's not the definition of a bona fide relationship, I'm not really sure what is.
Plus, why an American Muslim invites strangers over for dinner.
Because it's so easy to fear an other that you don't know.
And a Navajo family worries about the closure of a local coal-fired power plant.
I know how environmentalists feel differently about the power plant. I understand their views as well, but and somewhat, I guess you would say I'm a little selfish.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It's been on hold for months, but today it finally goes into effect. It, of course, is President Trump's crackdown on travel from six majority Muslim countries. The executive order had been held up in court since the early days of the new administration. This week, the Supreme Court allowed parts of it to stand, but said people with bona fide relationships in the U.S. can enter the country. Today, the Trump administration announced its definition of bona fide, but that's left opponents of the original order, like immigration attorney Carrie Doyle, still trying to figure out exactly what it means.
Well, according to the government's interpretation of the Supreme Court's ruling, they're only allowing individuals who are spouses, parents, children, and siblings to qualify for the exemption. They're not allowing grandparents, grandchildren, cousins, nieces, nephews, any of those sort of group of people to be exempt from the ban automatically.
Is there anything to compare that to? Are there certain standards that it strays from in terms of granting visa applications?
Well, I can only speculate, but my speculation is they're relying on how the Immigration Act and immigration laws actually define family. I think the one piece that's really troubling to us is that they've said that fiancés are not exempt from the ban. So a fiancé from one of the six countries would be banned from coming to the United States, which we find very troubling because fiancés are included in the Immigration Act and are allowed to be brought to the United States. And they obviously have a close relationship because the point of them coming is to get married. Other than that, they do seem to be taking, as again, I'm speculating, but it appears they're taking the definitions from how we normally define family within the immigration laws, what individuals are allowed to sponsor other individuals normally within the immigration system.
What about people who have job offers in the U.S. or people who may be studying here? How do the new guidelines affect them?
Well, the cable that we've seen issued by the Department of State does say that persons that have been accepted at a school that will be coming to study or persons that have bona fide job offers would be exempt from the Muslim ban. So presumably they'll be allowed to come to the United States. It's some of the other categories that I think are going to be much harder to discern if they're going to be allowed to come or not allowed to come. And then I think the refugee question is really one of the biggest questions left open by the cable. They don't really address a lot of the refugee issues very directly.
And the refugee piece of it is that at least for the next 120 days, there are no refugees being allowed in.
Right. They want to ban the refugees for 120 days. Unless they've already had this bona fide relationship, then they shouldn't be covered by the ban. But general refugees, I think, are really in trouble, and we'll have to see going forward what we can do about that.
We don't have many details on how the Trump administration will implement these new rules. Do you expect to see the same kind of chaos at U.S. airports that we saw when earlier versions were rolled out?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think we'll see the same chaos as in January with the first ban, in part because in January they implemented the ban literally while people were in the air or in the airports with no guidance and no advanced information. So in this case, they've at least waited the 72 hours, a little more than 72 hours to implement from the Supreme Court's ruling. And they've at least exempted some of the groups that already have visas that are arriving here this week, certainly exempted permanent residents. So it does seem to be somewhat more orderly. I don't think that means that there aren't going to be challenges and some chaos as far as who's being allowed to come and who isn't coming. And I know that some families, individuals, entities, schools, et cetera, will be negatively impacted by this. And chaos, if you will be more apart from the airports. We won't see it it'll happen at the consulates and via email and cables and that type of thing.
I imagine you and your colleagues will be monitoring the rollout of these travel restrictions. What will you be watching for?
Absolutely. So the American Immigration Lawyers Association, the New England chapter, we already have sign-ups. We've got attorneys signed up to be at the airport. So we'll just be there to monitor and make sure that no one's having issues at the airport and that no one gets put back on a plane and deported who should not be. And then also trying to stay in touch with some of the refugee resettlement groups to see what's happening with their people that they're bringing, the refugees that they're bringing, and to offer any support that they may want in trying to challenge some of the bans that are being held against some of their refugees.
Carrie Doyle is an immigration attorney in Boston. She's one of the lawyers who successfully filed a challenge against the president's original travel ban back in January. The imposition of the partial travel ban has thrown many potential immigrants and their families into a tailspin, even those that might still qualify to enter the U.S. Consider the case of Wissam Al-Badani. Al-Badani and his brother Khaled worked as interpreters for American troops in Iraq after the U.S. invasion. They're both U.S. citizens now, but they haven't been able to bring their elderly father to the U.S. Al-Badani says his dad is in danger because militants have targeted his entire family as traitors. He recalls the moment after U.S. troops withdrew when he learned his brother had been shot in the face outside a U.S. base.
When I get the news from one of my cousins, he said to me, like, hey, your brother shot in the hospital, come down. I will never forget that day. I will never forget that phone call. I kept it quiet. My mom, she was sitting making tea for me, and we were having a visitor that time. I took my keys. I sneak out from the door. My mother stopped me, and she said, what's going on? Why are you leaving now? I told her I have something I need to take care of. So I rushed to the hospital like crazy. I didn't believe the news. Like, what happened? How that happened? I don't know if he's alive or not.
What's wonderful is that he did survive. And then eventually you received a very different sort of threat. Tell us about that.
Yeah. In 2009, I find a letter in my windshield, and there was a bullet in this letter. I took the letter and I went upstairs. I opened it and I started reading the letter. It was telling me this is a group of militia. We know who you are and we know what you did. And one of those sentences they put very big on the letter, it's this bullet, it's for your heart because you served American. So we coming after you. Once I get that, I put the letter back, and I talked to my dad, and he asked me to leave the house and go hide somewhere, and that's what I did.
And you and your brother eventually received special immigrant visas and got to the U.S., but you've been focused now on bringing your father and younger siblings. Why?
That's correct. The people who know what we did, both of us, now they're looking after my family because of this. You know,
you mean they're targeting your family?
Yeah, they're targeting
or
they're
threatening
my
family. Your family.
Yes, and this is what we're trying to do. I'm trying to bring my family here, and this, believe it or not, happens since 2010.
So last summer, your father received a green light from U.S. Embassy officials. He's cleared to emigrate. He had a flight. He sold your family's house and all his possessions, and then his visa's denied. Why?
Correct. We don't really know why. That's what I've been trying to understand since then. We asked Homeland Security, we asked State Departments, give us a reason why they deny them. Absolutely no answers. Just deny for security purpose, and that's it. And that's what's drive us crazy. Like, how you deny a family, there is not just one member, there are three members of the same family served in the United States Army during the war in Iraq. This family is a threat to U.S. security. My uncle also, he was a translator back in 2007, my dad brother, and he get kidnapped and shot and killed back then because of his work. And this is what drive everyone crazy.
So sorry about your uncle. What's inspiring about your case is that, you know, you guys didn't take this sitting down. You got active about it, and mm-hmm. some U.S. military personnel and vets got active, and with lawyers and Gold Star parents. And so as of a few weeks ago, the visa denial was rescinded.
Correct.
And that's a huge accomplishment because that almost never happens. But even with that, you're back in limbo. What happened?
So I'm pretty sure you noticed that Trump put another hold on immigration process from the Supreme Court.
What the Supreme Court has issued is that it will hear the case for the Trump ban, but it's given certain conditions. And even with that second iteration of the ban that's being going to be considered, it doesn't include Iraq. So why is there still an issue about it?
I know that the ban is not didn't include Iraq, but include Muslims. And my family, they're Muslims. The whole process, they come and throw it. It's immigration and it's a refugees program. And he suspend that program for 120 days. And it will delay things. And my family cannot take any more delay. You know, they've been in this process since 2010. And we got, God knows what's going to happen after that delay, like after the 120 days, what he's going to come up with.
So your situation right now is, at the very least, your father and siblings have to wait another 120 days.
Correct.
To see if they're if they can get into the U.S.
Yes.
Do you talk to your dad back in Baghdad very often?
Almost every day.
How's he doing?
He recently did surgery, and he's recovering right now. I think what hurts him more, it's we are two different places. We can reach out each other, you know. We can help each other. Trump doesn't see the reality of innocent people stuck there.
So it's not just a system that's being delayed for 120 days. There's people's lives involved.
Correct. Those lives, you just basically given chances to bad people to come after my family and all those innocent people to kill them.
Wissam Abadani worked as an interpreter for U.S. troops in Iraq. He's been working to get his father and younger siblings into the U.S. Thanks, Wissam.
Thank you so much.
The long U.S. military involvement in Iraq conjures up all kinds of dark images. One of them is drones, pilotless aircraft coursing through the air as weapons and high-tech surveillance tools. But drones aren't just about war. In fact, the United Nations wants to use them for the exact opposite, humanitarian assistance. And the UN's just opened what may be the world's first site for testing humanitarian drones. Johannes Vedenig works for UNICEF in Malawi.
What is exciting in Malawi? It's a real-life corridor. It's big. It covers 5,000 square kilometers, where more than 600,000 people live. You find more than 300 schools and 450 health service delivery points. You can really explore real-life solutions where drones can make the difference.
UNICEF says it wants drone companies to test a variety of tasks in the area. They could deliver medicines to those health centers or learning materials to its schools. Vedenig says they could also help monitor and map disasters, but they'd need to work out a lot of challenges.
Just imagine you have a big scale emergency. You have many companies wanting to fly drones. Well, you have to coordinate it, and there has to be a drone traffic management system set up. So that's another case that we want to test.
But Vedenig says the drone network is only as powerful as the humans behind it.
Technology is only a part of the solution. Obviously, it's in the end always the human communication. It's how you use it sustainably and cost effectively. And there you need a real-life corridor to test it. And that's what we have here in Malawi.
Johannes Vedenig of UNICEF, talking about the UN's new project, testing humanitarian drones in Malawi. Just ahead, Cleveland wrestles with the effects of climate change. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Climate change is no longer a big priority for the U.S. government. President Trump's made that clear with his dramatic reversal of U.S. climate policy. But at the state and local level, it's a very different story. This week, for instance, more than 250 American mayors, Democrats and Republicans, together promised to increase local efforts to fight global warming and speed up the transition to clean energy. Environmentalists are using this supercharged moment in the national debate about climate policy to push more mayors to go green. But they say it's not just about saving the planet. The World's Jason Margolis went to Cleveland for our story.
Cleveland is a city divided by the Cuyahoga River between east and west. The east side, where Jocelyn Travis is from, is largely African American.
Let me show you where we kind of grew up playing in this area.
She takes me to a park and some ball fields.
The baseball diamonds, all my brothers grew up playing baseball. And so we had many family outings in this area and had no idea.
No idea about the pollutants belching from a coal-fired power plant nearby.
This was the sixth worst coal-burning power plant in the country.
in terms of pollution affecting low-income people of color. The plant was shut down 2 years ago, but other sources of pollution remain.
Cleveland was in the top 10 cities that had the most preventable deaths related to air quality issues.
Christy Ross is a pediatric pulmonologist with Cleveland's Case Western Reserve School of Medicine. She sees a lot of children from Cleveland's east side dealing with health issues related to air pollution.
Asthma, reductions in lung growth, even in children who do not have asthma.
Poor air quality can also affect cognitive development. But what do sick kids have to do with climate change? For one thing, the sources of local pollution are also drivers of climate change. But the connection doesn't stop there. Ross's colleague, pediatrician Aparna Bol, joined our discussion via speakerphone.
The length and intensity of aeroallergen season is greater with climate change, both because of the longer warm season and higher carbon dioxide concentration, changing patterns of infectious disease, migrating northward where we never saw so many tick-borne illnesses before this far north. Now we do. That's already happening.
She says climate change is a public health crisis, but also an opportunity.
All of the action that would be required to transform into a clean energy economy, as well as a more sustainable transportation infrastructure, all of those interventions have immediate health benefits.
So back to Jocelyn Travis. She's now working with the Sierra Club's Ready for 100 campaign.
Ready for 100 is a campaign with the goal of getting, nationally, a goal of getting 100 cities to become 100% clean, renewable energy.
To be achieved by the year 2050. Nearly 125 mayors have already committed to reaching that goal, from Salt Lake City to San Diego to Abita Springs, Louisiana. Travis says they're building a coalition of community activists to push Cleveland's mayor to go beyond words of support to fight climate change and join the list. I requested an interview with Mayor Frank Jackson, but his press office turned down my requests. Travis admits drumming up support to fight climate change in her neighborhood, it can be a tough sell.
You know, you've got a lot of unemployment. You've got a lot of health issues. You know, there's so many issues that in the black community, people are just trying to survive.
So when she's out on the streets talking climate change, she's not talking about rising sea levels or melting glaciers.
Because we got to make it relate to people. Most of our households or our family or friends, we know somebody who has asthma, or we know somebody who needs a job.
And jobs in renewable energy? They're coming to Cleveland soon.
The first freshwater wind farm will be built about 8 to 10 miles off the coast from where we're standing right now.
That's Lori Wagner, the president of LEEDCO, a public-private partnership building a wind farm off the shores of Lake Erie.
You get 3 to 5 times the energy from the wind that you do on land because it is so much more sustained and higher speed.
Wagner is helping put up 6 turbines, creating 500 construction jobs. Eventually, he hopes to harness enough gusts from Lake Erie to power 10% of Ohio.
When we start looking at our vision of where we could be by 2030, it's more on the order of 8,000 jobs, building an industry, about $13 billion into the local economy.
The wind farm is being privately financed. Still, Wagner says it'd be easier to move forward with more government support. The Trump administration wants to cut federal support for renewable energies in favor of more gas and oil exploration. It's the same story coming from Ohio's Republican-led state legislature at the Capitol in Columbus. Representative Bill Seitz is leading the charge to eliminate the state's clean energy mandates. He says in Ohio, they should be investing in natural gas.
Ohio sits on an absolute fountain of natural gas. So I say, dance with who brung you to the dance. That is the resource we have. That is the resource should be used for creating electricity in Ohio for at least the next 40 years.
For many of Ohio's conservatives, natural gas means jobs and abundant, cheap energy. But while it burns cleaner than coal, natural gas still produces a lot of climate-warming emissions. When we spoke, Seitz wasn't concerned about climate change or the prospect of Cleveland committing to renewables.
They're free to do that right now. That's perfectly fine with me. They can become as green as they want to be as long as they're willing to pay the price.
Seitz argues that turning away from natural gas will result in energy price spikes. Environmentalists argue that the price of renewable energy has become increasingly cost competitive and, in fact, cheaper in parts of Ohio. Jocelyn Travis says the lack of support from Columbus and Washington makes the push toward renewable energy in Cleveland more difficult, but it also deepens the resolve to go local.
Cities have got to step up at this point. A lot of cities throughout Ohio look to Cleveland to be the leader. I really believe that if Cleveland makes a commitment, other cities will come along.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Cleveland.
Being a hero is not often like what you see in the movies. We now know more about one of the heroes of the attack in London earlier this month. That's when three men drove a van into a crowd on London Bridge, got out and stabbed 8 people to death and wounded another 48 before the men were killed by authorities. One of those injured was Transport Officer Wayne Marks. Marks is also one of the people credited with taking the attackers on, armed only with a baton. Well, he's finally out of the hospital and he's told the BBC what happened when he charged at the attackers.
While I'm fighting the first one, I get a massive whack to the right side of my head. Thought maybe it was a metal pole or bar at first. Afterwards, I realized it was a knife. Soon as I get the whack on the side of my head, my right eye goes dark, just lights out.
Mark says he felt like he was in a surreal cowboy movie.
And while I'm fighting, my left leg starts wobbling. I'm thinking, what the hell's wrong with my leg? What's wrong with my leg? And I look down, and I see there's a knife in the side of my leg.
Soon after that, Mark says his vision faded to black.
Time was up, as far as I was concerned. So the officer that's holding my hand, I call his name, and he lowers down the radio when he comes in close. And I started giving him my last messages to, you know, my family, my partner. And then the last little bit of light went, and then that was it. I was out. Next clear memory I have is waking up in hospital.
Mark suffered major injuries to his head and leg. He says the vision in his right eye has returned, but he doesn't know whether he'll be able to go back to work.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills. A Muslim woman in Michigan invites strangers over for a meal.
I turned to my husband and said, let's invite some people over for dinner, strangers that might have never met a Muslim before, and allow them the opportunity to get to know the real Islam.
Finding common ground around the dining room table. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Germany has passed a barrage of new surveillance measures in recent months, 17 to be exact. The country's historically been wary of government surveillance, but officials say they need the new policies to fight terrorism. Critics say the measures infringe on civil liberties. Jefferson Chase is a reporter for Deutsche Welle. He says the policies gained momentum after the Christmas market attack in Berlin last December.
That was obviously a very shocking event in Berlin, because even though it wasn't as large a scale of an attack as the ones that had happened, for instance, in London, it was the first time that the German capital had ever been hit. And of course, the Christmas market was a very, very soft target. And so people were very upset. One of the consequences of that, I mean, I think that Germans and the German government responded in very measured fashion to the attack. They didn't get all hysterical, but it became easier to push through laws and other projects that may have been in the works for a while, but now there was a kind of an impetus behind it. So I think that's why you're seeing, you know, a whole spate of laws and other government measures where the state is encroaching more and more on ordinary people.
Which policies or proposed legislation stand out for you?
I mean, one that's standing out right now is a piece of legislation I've translated as the Telecommunications Data Retention Law. This was a law that was going to require cell phone companies to store people's data and metadata for 6 months. And then if for any reason the police or, you know, other authorities needed it, they would ask for it. What makes this very disturbing to Germans is that it's targeting everybody. It's just a dragnet. Everybody's data, metadata gets fed into this pool. And although the authorities say that they would only ever use this for very serious crimes, then you get into the definition of what is a serious crime. A lot of people feel that this could be a slippery slope. And the reason I say that that's standing out right now is a local court has just ruled it to be in violation of European law. And one of the German agencies says they're not going to enforce the law for the time being. So it's an example of a pushback against this spate of new laws.
I took note of one of them, which is Germany was considering lowering the minimum age for monitoring by intelligence agencies from 16 years to 14 years old. What's the status of that proposal that would effectively keep an eye on teens suspected of being radicalized?
It's still on the table. You know, we'll wait and see. I mean, it's obviously been very controversial because when you get down to the age of 14, you're starting to get into that area where is a 14-year-old a full-blown teenager or is that person more of a child? That particular measure came in response to some discoveries that were made that very young people were getting involved in radical Islamist movements. There were a couple of cases in Germany, and so there was a suggestion made that the age be lowered. That's, you know, one of the things that's very much up in the air, and it's one of the things that's kind of splitting German opinion, if you will, right down the middle.
Is the public reaction to these surveillance measures one that's saying, hey, look at our history, you know, we just can't go there? Or is it other reasons that people are objecting?
I think it's a little of both. I mean, obviously, you know, everything that happens in Germany is in some sense filtered or inflected through the past. However, I think it would be wrong to just reduce it to people saying that after Nazism, we can't have any sort of this stuff anymore. I mean, a lot of the debate in Germany is very modern, actually. I think it's the same sort of debates that people probably in Britain or in the United States have because of the new technologies. Germany, like I think all modern societies, is trying to sort out how do we balance the need to keep the public secure with people's desire to have their personal information remain private.
Is there enough political opposition to thwart some of these new policies?
Well, there may be. And I say that because we're in an election year this year. And so it's going to depend upon who gets in power after Germany goes to the polls on September 24th. And a party that's not in parliament right now, but that will probably get back into it, is called the Free Democratic Party. This party has said they are not going to enter into any coalition if there's more of these laws on the cards. And of course, the law that I cited just a little while ago illustrates that there's a lot of pushback from NGOs and from other parts of the non-political society, and there are going to be an awful lot of lawsuits in the coming months and maybe years to try to determine how much of this legislation is actually constitutional.
Jefferson Chase is a reporter for Deutsche Welle in Berlin. There's nothing like sharing a meal to help get to know someone new. That can be especially true if that person is from a different background. Earlier this week, President Trump chose not to hold the traditional dinner marking the end of the Muslim holiday Ramadan, breaking with 20 years of tradition at the White House. But in Michigan, one Muslim woman is starting a new tradition, inviting strangers over for dinner at her own house to talk about Islam. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Growing up, there was one TV show Amanda Saab would not miss.
I especially loved watching Iron Chef America.
Get a little whipped cream like that. A little more whipped cream like that.
I would like watch Emerald Live and like try to make the recipe myself, and then I'd like miss something or, you know, something would be off, but then I'd figure it out because it was like trial and error. So
Amanda was born in Michigan to Lebanese American parents. She's always been a cook at heart. She was even on MasterChef. And her family's meals have always been a mix of two worlds.
Traditional American burgers and fries and pizzas and pastas. We grew up eating that, but as well as the Lebanese food, which is the ultimate comfort food for me.
These days, Amanda works for a nonprofit near Detroit. And in the evenings, she unleashes her inner foodie. She's at home preparing iftar, or the meal Muslims eat at sunset to break their fast during Ramadan. Potatoes turn golden in a pan. The kitchen smells of jasmine rice.
I like to add the spices in
with the vegetables while I'm cooking them.
Amanda says a lot has changed over the past year. The U.S. has a new president who isn't exactly bringing Muslims and non-Muslims together. There's a disconnect, us versus them. People just don't talk to each other as much as they should, she says. So, one night, she had an idea.
I turned to my husband and said, let's invite some people over for dinner. You know, strangers that we've never met, that might have never met a Muslim before, and allow them the opportunity to get to know the real Islam.
Dinner with Your Muslim Neighbor was born. It works like this. Every month, Amanda and her husband post a message on Facebook and Twitter, inviting strangers over for dinner. They go through responses and come up with a list of about 10 guests. Then they get cooking. Over dishes like Lebanese-style meatballs and roasted cauliflower, the guests talk about Islam. Why do Muslims believe in one God? Does Islam have sects like Christianity does? Is she forced to wear the hijab? Amanda and her husband aren't academics. They just talk about their faith as they understand it. And they hope the dinners start conversations with people like the men Amanda overheard at a store recently.
I was in line and there was, you know, some tabloids and I was just like reading the headlines and one stood out and I was like, oh my goodness. You know, it was like, ISIS is in your backyard, like so terrible. So then, you know, a man came up behind me and he was buying a rifle rack and he was dressed in head-to-toe camo. And then another man came up behind him and he said, oh, you got to protect yourself from that, and pointed at the magazine. And then the other man said, no, no, you got to protect yourself from that, and he pointed at me.
Amanda didn't feel safe to respond. She was hurt. And it stuck with her, this idea that neighbors can feel so far apart. And that's what she wants to change.
Because it's so easy to fear an other that you don't know. If you can put a face to anyone, like, oh, I know a Muslim Amanda, you know, down the street. They're not really like, you know, all these bad things. Then you're not going to think, oh, I can just generalize a whole religion of 1.6 billion people.
Amanda and her husband have hosted 15 dinners so far. She's working on posting a guide online so that other people, she hopes other American Muslims, can throw their own dinners. But can a dinner change the opinion of, say, those men she overheard at the store? She says it doesn't hurt trying.
At the end of the dinners, we often hear, oh, we're just like you, and you're just like us. I'm like, exactly. And it just took a simple meal, you know, for us to realize that.
And the one guest Amanda dreams of hosting, Donald Trump. For The World, Shirin Jafari, Michigan.
It's a big week for the future of the Navajo Nation. That's the sprawling Native American territory in the Southwest. The government there is racing to finalize a plan to keep one of the biggest coal-fired power plants in the country from going dark. If they don't, the plant will start shutting down. If they do, it'll stay open another 2 years, possibly more. Yesterday, we heard from the Navajo president. He's been struggling to deal with the potential lost revenue and jobs from the plant and from a nearby coal mine. Today, The World's Environment reporter Carolyn Beeler brings us the story of one Navajo family and its relationship with the power plant.
At night in the dark northern Arizona desert, the Navajo generating station looks like it's been draped in Christmas lights. It's not part of the skyline, it is the skyline, and it's an equally outsized part of this man's life.
We're going to go ahead and start the chapter meeting.
My name is Jerry Williams, and I work at the Navajo generating station.
Williams is also head of the Navajo community next door to the plant, where he's running a meeting tonight.
So I have two hats that I wear here in the community.
Both of Williams' roles are closely linked to the massive power plant. Income from the plant and the coal mine that supplies it pay for staffers and keep the lights on in this local government building. The plant has also meant a good job for Williams near where he grew up.
The wage that I get working there, I'm grateful. It keeps me close to my community and allows me to do what I want to do.
Besides serving his community, that means raising his three kids in the Navajo culture and making enough money to put all three of them through college at once.
Growing up here near the reservation was actually really beneficial for us as Navajos.
Here's Michaela, who's 25 and the oldest Williams kid. I talked to her and her siblings outside the local community building while their dad was running the meeting inside.
Our grandparents, they actually live about 30 minutes away from here, and we were just around our family all the time.
We learn a lot of things, cultural values, you know.
That's Mallory, the middle child. The kids grew up in a small town just off the reservation, a couple miles from where we're talking, but they visited the reservation a lot, and they kept cattle there. This is Garrison, the youngest.
If you were to move into a city, especially for Navajo culture, you wouldn't be surrounded like your grandparents. You wouldn't have the ability to see, like, livestock, you know, feed animals. You get away from your language, your ceremonies, your songs, so then you're not going to learn your own culture.
People here worry that's what's going to happen now that the plant's owners say they're going to shut it down. They fear the community and culture will be hurt as more than 700 jobs and tens of millions of dollars in revenue disappear. But that's not the whole story. The Navajo Generating Station is also a major source of smog and greenhouse gases. So the move to close the plant also begs a tough question for this family.
Is there an upside to this? Are you in any way glad to see it closing in terms of environmental impact?
Honestly,
here's Mallory Williams again.
My dad works there. A lot of his income is what's taking me, my sister, and my little brother through school. Other than that, I know how environmentalists feel differently about the power plant. I understand their views as well, but in somewhat, I guess you would say I'm a little selfish.
It's really hard because to us, it's disrespectful to go against your parents at times, especially since they're the ones that have given you food and given you life.
Michaela and Mallory and their brother Garrison are all fiercely loyal to their parents. But they also recognize the link between climate change and the smokestacks they can see from basically anywhere in town.
As traditional Navajos, we believe that we're here to protect the earth. I want to protect the earth as well. I want to be part of that. For me, I actually wish that maybe a few years ago that Navajo Nation would have actually jumped onto solar wind. But at the same time, I do understand, like, my family does benefit off the power plant.
You can hear that the kids are a little conflicted. Their father, Jerry, not so much.
I know there's, if we look out there, things being omitted into the air. But it's not bad to where, as the way people put it.
That's a matter of perspective. The Navajo Generating Station is one of the top 10 greenhouse gas polluters in the entire U.S. But for Williams, it's far too important to lose. So he's been crisscrossing the Navajo Nation, advocating for a plan to keep the power plant open for at least a couple more years. Navajo leaders are racing to finalize that plan by Saturday's deadline. Williams hopes they do, and that buys enough time to find new owners to keep the plant open longer. If not, he says,
I'll probably be the last one out, turn the lights off, and then I'll see what I can do after that.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler from the Navajo Nation.
Tomorrow, we'll hear a different, very different perspective on the same story from a family of Navajo environmental activists who would be happy to see the power plant close. What is it that makes us human? For many people, it's our skulls. Anthropologists say the size and shape of the skulls of modern humans are what distinguish us from earlier species like Homo erectus. And it seems that some of our ancestors may have understood this. Scientists have just published a study of what may be the world's oldest temple, and it contains evidence of what they're calling a skull cult. The temple is in southeastern Turkey and was built around 9,000 years ago. That's a good 4,000 years before Stonehenge and the pyramids. This has all gotten the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe, very excited. Chris, what makes you so excited?
Well, the thing that most amazes me, Carol, is that this is the Stone Age. We're talking about people whose only tools are made of stone, hence the Stone Age. And yet they're able to erect this huge temple complex on top of a mountain with almost nothing. They haven't invented the wheel yet. And then you think, how do they even get everybody there and fed? These are hunters and gatherers. They have to go out and hunt animals or gather, you know, wild berries and grains to try and feed themselves. And yet they've got all these people here. They've been able to organize themselves so that they can find the time and the people with the skills to make these exquisite pieces of art and architecture. It's just mind-blowing to me. And then there's all these skulls.
What is it with the skulls? What did they find?
Well, they found a very disproportionate number of skull bones in the remains of the complex, scattered around amongst these concentric circles of standing stones and in these different chambers of rooms that are still to be found there. Disproportionate meaning like 2/3 of the bones they've found are from skulls. And they've been trying to piece together what they did with them and what may have happened to the people who were there. Now, this is not the first skull cult to be found in the Eastern Mediterranean. It was apparently quite common at this time, around 9,000 years ago. And if you think about it, this is the first evidence of organized religion or some kind of ritual anywhere in the world of any human culture. I'm sure people have had, you know, other places of worship and other places of ritual in humanity's long and storied lifetime. But it's like this is the first evidence we have of it actually taking place on this hilltop in Turkey.
What is the evidence? What makes it a temple?
Well, there's no evidence that people actually lived there. So it seems to be mainly a ceremonial purpose. There's nobody buried there, which is another unusual thing. Usually where people live, they die. So clearly people were coming together here for some purpose other than, you know, mere subsistence.
What is the theory about how people got organized in this place at this time, 9,000 years ago?
Right. It is remarkable because, like, your average hunter-gatherer group lives in a small band of, like, 12 to 20 people, and you spend all your time hunting and gathering food. And so the theory is that this is a place in the world where wild grains grow, wheat, naturally, on the hillsides. And they think, one of the pioneers, German researcher who first came across this site, proposes that that people had to organize themselves to protect these fields of wild grain from animals. And so that they had to come together in bigger bands for the first time in human history, possibly, to protect these wild grain fields. And obviously, they were able to sustain a bigger population with them as well.
So you mentioned all these fragments of skulls. What makes it a skull cult?
Well, clearly this played some kind of central role in the rituals or the belief system of the people who occupied this site. And we're talking like 9,000 years ago. And what's unique about the ones that have been discovered is that they've clearly been carved into. These weren't just like wounds that you might find on a human remains, or they weren't form of ritualistic killing. Clearly, this is a post-mortem modification of the skull, and it looks like they've been designed to be dangling from the ceiling. So you get this very dramatic imagery of these semi-subterranean vaults that people have come into, probably torchlit, all these mysterious carvings on the walls, and these skulls dangling from the ceiling. So it must have been a very intimidating place, but it's not clear if this was for the purposes of frightening people or for commemorating and venerating your ancestors or something in between. Right now, we just don't know.
Exciting stuff. The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
Finally today, fatbergs. Yep, like icebergs, only made of cooking oil, fat, and other things people dump down their drains. The stuff cools, congeals, and before you know it, the pipes are blocked up. In London, it's estimated that fatbergs cause some 80% of all sewer blockages. But now one British company is trying to make something useful out of those bergs. They're turning them into biofuel. My BBC colleague Nick Holland is the latest to brave London's sewers to get the story.
Right, just squeeze in through this little hole, and then we go into the down into the sewers.
In the sewers under Whitehall in London, Thames Water are checking for fatbergs. It's not long before they find one, a congealed brown blob mixed with poo, wee, wet wipes, and whatever else. It's 3 metres long by 4 metres wide, but that's just on the surface.
How deep would that be, do you think, that fatberg there?
That's about 4 foot deep down there, with a layer of fat on it about almost 2 feet thick.
My name's Phil Fawn, I work for Thames Water. The problems of fatbergs is a real nuisance to us.
How do you get it out?
We have to get contracted in with these jetting unit machines. They can break it up and try and suck it out. That's how bad it is, yeah.
Once fatbergs are removed, most of them go to landfill. But now there's an alternative to disposal. A green fuel manufacturer, Argent Energy, wants them. It's figured out a way of turning them into biodiesel, a low-carbon emission fuel that can power cars and lorries. So it's collecting fatbergs and taking them to their £75 million processing plant.
So we've got a truck of this fat from the sewer. We're about to reverse it into the building. We've got a fairly significant pit here in the ground, and we're about to tip that tanker into the pit.
Heather Swinbank is the company's biofuels sourcing manager.
So we heat it, we take it up to somewhere around about 70, 80 degrees. We want the oil and fat fraction, the water and the contamination we've just talked about, that's the bit we don't want.
The fat, oil and grease gets melted down out of the fatberg and then pumped round a cleaning process to filter out all the other nasty stuff that it's mixed with.
You can see inside this large vat there's a thick, dark liquid and it's been sucked into a huge, porous, hollow drum. Imagine a 10-metre-long corn on the cob, but instead of being covered in sweet corn, it's got a fine layer of sawdust on the outside. And as the liquid passes through it, the sawdust filters out the really fine impurities that previous bits of the cleaning process just couldn't capture.
What comes out the other end is a sweet-scented usable oil that's converted into biodiesel. The company says it's hoping eventually the site will produce 90 million litres of the fuel a year. That won't solve the world's energy problems, but it's more than all the sustainable biodiesel used in the UK in 2016. Argent Energy don't encourage people to dispose of their cooking fats down the sink, but for as long as fatbergs are in the sewers, it argues it might as well make something useful out of them.
The BBC's Nick Holland there. He's a brave guy. And that's a wrap for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.